first range marker, this ridge of corpses that got higher and higher each minute. We were actually building an undead fortification, creating a situation where all we had to do was pop every head that popped over the top. The brats had planned for this. They had a periscope tower thingy that let officers see right over the wall. They also had real-time downlinks from satellites and recon drones, although we, the grunts, had no idea what they were seeing. Land Warrior was gone for now, so all we had to do was concentrate on what was in front of our faces. We started getting contacts from all sides, either coming around the wall or else being drawn in from our flanks and even rear. Again, the brass was waiting for this and ordered us to form an RS.
A reinforced square. But you did have enough ammunition.
More than enough. The vehicles were packed to their roofs. We had water, we had replacements. If you needed a fiver, you just raised your weapon and one of the Sandlers would jump in and take our place on the firing line. You'd grab a bite of eye ration, soak your face, stretch, drain the weasel. No one would ever volunteer for a fiver, but they had these KO-9 teams, combat shrinks, who were observing everyone's performance. They'd been with us since our early days on the range, knew us each by name and face, and knew, don't ask me how, when the stress of battle was starting to degrade our performance. We didn't know. I certainly didn't. There were a couple of times I'd miss a shot, or maybe take a half second instead of a full, then suddenly I'd get this tap on my shoulder, and I knew I was out of it for five.
What about at night?
We used searchlights from the vehicles, powerful, red-coated beams so it didn't mess with your night vision. The only creepy thing about night fighting, other than the redness from the lights, is the glow a round makes when it enters the head. That's why we call them cherry pies, because if the bullet's chem comp wasn't mixed right, it would burn so bright it made their eyes glow red. That was a cure for constipation, especially later on nights when you pulled guard duty and one would come out of you out of the dark. Those glowing red eyes, frozen in time the second before it falls.
How did you know the battle was over?
When we stopped shooting? No, actually, that's a good question. Around 0400 it started to taper off. Heads weren't poking out as much. The moan was dying down. The officers didn't tell us the attack was almost over, but you could see them looking through their scopes, talking on their radios. You could see the relief in their faces. I think the last shot was fired just before dawn. After that, we were just waiting for the first light. It was kind of eerie, the sun rising over this mountainous ring of corpses. We were totally walled in. All sides were piled at least 20 feet high and over 100 feet deep. I'm not sure how many we killed that day. Stats always vary on who you get it from. The Dozer Blade Humvees had to push a path through the corpse ring just to let us get out. There were still living G's, some slow ones who were late to the party, or who had tried to climb up and over their dead friends and had slid back down into the mound. When we started burying the bodies, they came tumbling out. That was the only time Senior Lobo saw any action. At least we didn't have to stick around for BS duty. They had another unit waiting in reserve to clean up. I guess the brass figured we'd done enough for one day. We marched 10 miles to the east, set up a bivouac with watchtowers and concertainer walls. I was so damn beat. I don't remember the chem shower, turning in my gear to be disinfected, turning in my weapon for inspection. Not one jam, not the whole unit. I don't even remember slipping into my bag. They let us sleep as late as we wanted the next day. That was pretty sweet. Eventually the voices woke me up, everyone jawing, laughing, telling stories. It was a different vibe, 180 from 2 days ago. I couldn't really put a finger on what I was feeling. Maybe it was what the president said about reclaiming our future. I just knew it felt good, better than I had the entire war. I knew it was going to be a real long-ass road. I knew our campaign across America was just beginning. But hey, as the prez said later that first night, at least it was the beginning of the end.
Ainsworth, Nebraska, USA. Darnell Hackworth is a shy, soft-spoken man. He and his wife run a retirement farm for the four-legged veterans of the Army's Canine Corps. 10 years ago, farms like these could be found in almost every state in the Union. Now, this is the only one left.
They never get enough credit, I think. There's that story, Dax. nice little children's book, but it's pretty simplistic, and it's only about one Dalmatian that helped an orphan kid find his way to safety. Dax wasn't even in the military, and helping lost children was a tiny fraction of Dog's overall contribution to the fight. The first thing they used dogs for was triage, letting them sniff for who was infected. Most countries were just copying the Israeli method of sending people past dogs in cages. You always had to keep them in cages, otherwise they might attack the person, or each other, or even their handler. There was a lot of that. Early in the war, dogs just going ballistic. It didn't matter if they were police or military. It's that instinct, that involuntary, almost genetic terror. Fight or flight. And those dogs were bred to fight. A lot of handlers lost hands, arms, a lot of throats got torn out. Can't blame the dogs for it. In fact, that instinct was what the Israelis were counting on, and it probably saved millions of lives. It was a great program, but, again, just a fraction of what dogs were truly capable of. Whereas the Israelis and, after them, a lot of other countries only tried to exploit that terror instinct, we thought we could integrate it into their regular training. And why not? We learned to do it for ourselves. And are we really that much more evolved? It all came down to training. You had to start young. Even the most disciplined pre-war veterans were hardwired berserkers. The pups born after the crisis came out of the womb, literally smelling the dead. It was in the air, not enough for us to detect, but just a few molecules, an introduction on a subconscious level. That's not to say it made all of them automatic warriors. The initial induction was the first and most important phase. You took a group of pups, a random group, or even a whole litter, put them in a room divided by a wire mesh. They're on one side, Zach's on the other. You didn't have to wait long for a reaction. The first group we called bees. They'd start whimpering or howling. They'd lost it. They were nothing like the A's. Those pups would lock eyes with Zach. That was the key. They'd stand their ground, bare their teeth, and let out this low growl that said, "Back the fuck off." They could control themselves, and that was the foundation of our program. Now, just because they could control themselves didn't mean that we could control them. Basic training was pretty much like the standard pre-war program. Could they handle PT? Could they follow orders? Did they have the intelligence, the discipline to make soldiers? It was hard going, and we had a 60% washout rate. It wasn't uncommon for a recruit to be badly injured, perhaps even killed. A lot of people nowadays call that inhumane, though they don't seem to have the same sympathy for the handlers. Yeah, we had to do it too, right alongside the dogs. Right from day one of basic, through 10 more weeks of AIT. It was hard training, especially the live enemy exercises. You know, we were the first ones to use Zach in our field training, before the infantry, before the special forces, even before the Zoomies at Willow Creek. It was the only way to really know if you could hack it, both as an individual and as a team. How else could you have sent them on so many different missions? There were lures, the kind that the Battle of Hope made famous. Pretty simple stuff. Your partner hunts for Zach, then leads him into our firing line. K's on early missions used to be fast, run in, bark, then jam it for the kill zone. Later, they got more comfortable. They learned to stay just a few feet ahead, backing away slowly, making sure they herded the maximum amount of targets. And that way, they actually called the shots. They were also decoys. Let's say you were setting up a firing line, but you didn't want Zach to show up too early. Your partner would circle around the infested zone and only start barking on the far side. That worked with a lot of engagements, and it opened the door for the lemming tactic. During the Denver push, It was a tall building where a couple hundred refugees had accidentally been locked in with the infection and were now completely reanimated. Before our guys could storm the entrance, one of the K's had his own idea to run up to the roof of a building across the street and start barking to draw Zack up onto the higher floors. It worked like a dream. The G's made it up to the roof, saw their prey, made for him, and went spilling over the side. After Denver, Lemming went right into the playbook. Even the infantry started using it when K's weren't available. It wasn't uncommon to see a grunt standing on the roof of a building, calling out to an infested building close by. But the primary and most common mission of any K-team was scouting, both SC and LRP. SC is sweep and clear, just attached to a regular unit, like conventional warfare. That's where training really paid off. Not only could they sniff Zack out miles before us, but the sounds they made always told you exactly what to expect. You could tell everything you needed to know by the pitch of the growl and the frequency of the bark. Sometimes, when silence was required, body language worked just as well. The arch of the K's back, the raising of Dander, was all you needed to see. After a few missions, any competent handler, and we had no other kind, could read his partner's every signal. Scouts finding a ghoul half-submerged in mud or legless among tall grass saved a lot of lives. I can't tell you how many times a grunt would thank us personally for spotting a concealed G that might have taken his foot off. LRP was long-range patrol, when your partner would scout far beyond your lines, sometimes even traveling for days, to recon an infested area. They wore a special harness with a video uplink, a GPS tracker that gave you real-time intel on the exact number and position of your targets. You could overlay Zack's position on a pre-existing map, coordinating what your partner saw with his position on the GPS. I guess from a technical side, it was pretty amazing. Real-time hard intel, like we used to have before the war. The brass loved it. I didn't. I was always too concerned with my partner. I can't tell you how stressful that was, to be standing in some computer-filled air-conditioned room, safe, comfortable, and totally helpless. Later harness models had radio uplinks, so a handler could relay orders or, at least, abort the mission. I never worked with them. Teams had to be trained on those from the beginning. You couldn't go back and retrain a seasoned K. You couldn't teach an old dog new tricks. Sorry, bad joke. I heard a lot of those from the intel pukes, standing behind them as they watched the damn monitor, mentally stroking it to the wonders of their new data orientation asset. They thought they were so witty. Real fun for us to have DOA as an acronym.
He shakes his head.
I just had to stand there, thumb up my ass, watching my partner's POV as she crept through some forest or marsh or town. Towns and cities, that was the hardest. That was my team's specialty. Houndtown, you ever heard of that?
The Canine Urban Warfare School.
That's it. A real town, Mitchell, Oregon. Sealed off, abandoned, and still filled with active G's. Houndtown. It actually should have been called Terrytown, because most of the breeds at Mitchell were small terriers. Little Cairns and Norwiches and JRs, good for rubble and narrow choke points. Personally, the Hound in Houndtown suited me just fine. I worked with the Dackle. They were, by far, the ultimate urban war fighters. Tough, smart, and especially the Minis, completely at home in confined spaces. In fact, that's what they were originally bred for. Badger dog. That's what Dachshund means in German. That's why they had that hot dog look, so they could hunt in low, narrow badger burrows. You see how that kind of breeding already made them suited to the ducks and crawl spaces of an urban battleground. The ability to go through a pipe, an air shaft, in between walls, whatever, without losing their cool, was a major survival asset.
We are interrupted. As if on cue, a dog limps over to Darnell's side. She is old. Her muzzle is white. The fur on her ears and tail is worn to leather. Darnell says to the dog,
"Hey, little miss."
Darnell gingerly lifts her to his lap. She is small, no more than 8 or 9 pounds. Although she bears some resemblance to a smooth-haired miniature dachshund, her back is shorter than the standard breed. To the dog, Darnell says,
"You doing okay, Maze? You feel all right?"
To me, he says,
"Her full name's Maisie, but we never used it. Maze was pretty fitting, don't you think?"
With one hand he massages her back legs, while with the other he rubs under her neck. She looks up at him with milky eyes. She licks his palm.
"Pure Bloods were a total washout. Too neurotic, too many health problems. Everything you'd expect from breeding an animal for just its aesthetic qualities. The new generation..."
He gestures to the mud on his lap.
"Was always a mix. Whatever would increase both physical constitution and mental stability."
The dog has gone to sleep. Darnell lowers his voice.
"They were tough. Took a lot of training, not just individually, but for working in groups on LRP missions. Long range, especially over wild terrain, was always risky. Not just from Zack, but also from feral caves. Remember how bad they were? All those pets and strays that generated into killer packs? They were always a concern, usually in transition through low infestation zones, always looking for something to eat. A lot of LRP missions were aborted in the beginning before we deployed escort dogs."
He refers to the sleeping dog.
"She had two escorts. Pongo, who was a pit rock mix, and Purdy. I don't really know what Purdy was, part shepherd, part stegosaurus. I wouldn't have let her anywhere near them if they hadn't gone through basic with their handlers. They actually turned out to be first-rate escorts. 14 times they chased off feral packs. Twice they really got into it. I watched Purdy go after this 200-pound mastiff, grab its skull and her jaws. You could actually hear the crack over the harness's surveillance mic. The toughest part for me was making sure Maze stuck to the mission. She always wanted to fight."
He smiles down at the sleeping dachshund.
"They were good escorts. Always made sure she got to her target objective. Waited for her, and always got her home safely. You know, they even took down a few G's in transit."
"But isn't Z flesh toxic?"
"Oh yeah. No, they never bit. That would have been fatal. You've seen a lot of dead caves in the beginning of the war, just lying there, no wounds. And you knew they had bitten infected flesh. That's one of the reasons training was so important. They had to know how to defend themselves. Zack's got a lot of physical advantages, but balance isn't one of them. The bigger caves could always hit between the shoulder blades or the small of the back, just knock them on their faces. The minis had the option of tripping, getting underfoot, or launching themselves at the knee pit. Maze always preferred that. Dropped them right on their backs."
The dog stirs. Darnell says to her,
"Oh, sorry, little miss."
And then he strokes the back of her neck. To me, he says,
"By the time Zack got back up, you bought yourself 5, maybe 10, 15 seconds. We had our share of casualties. Some caves would have a fall, break a bone. If they were close to friendly forces, their handler could pick them up pretty easily, get them to safety. Most of the time, they even returned to active duty."
"What about the other times?"
"If they were too far, a lure or an LRP, too far for rescue and too close to Zack, we petitioned for mercy charges. Little explosive packs strapped to the harness so we could detonate them if it looked like there wasn't any chance of rescue. We never got them. A waste of valuable resources. Cocksuckers. Putting a wounded soldier out of misery was a waste, but turning them into fragmuts now, that they consider."
"Excuse me?"
"Fragmuts. That was an unofficial name for the program that almost got the green light. Some staff asshole read that the Russians had used mine dogs during World War II, strapped explosives to their backs and trained them to run under Nazi tanks. The only reason Ivan ended his program was the same reason we'd never began ours. The situation was no longer desperate enough. How fucking desperate do you have to be? They'll never say it, but I think what stopped them was the threat of another Eckhart incident. That really woke them up. You know about that, right? Sergeant Eckhart, God bless her. She was a senior handler, operated up with AGN. I never met her. Her partner was pulling a lure mission outside Little Rock. Fell in a ditch, broke his leg. The swarm was only a few steps away. Eckhart grabbed a rifle, tried to go out after him. Some officer got in her face, started spouting regs and half-assed justifications. She emptied half a clip in his mouth. MPs tackled her ass, held her on the ground. She could hear everything as the dead surrounded her partner.
What happened?
They hung her. Public execution. Real high profile. I understand. No, I really do. Discipline was everything. Rule of law. That's all we had. But you better fucking believe there were some changes. Handlers were allowed to go after their partners, even if it meant risking their own lives. We weren't considered assets anymore. We were half assets. For the first time, the Army saw us as teams. That a dog wasn't just a piece of machinery you could replace when broken. They started looking at statistics of handlers who offed themselves after losing a partner. You know, we had the highest rate of suicide among any branch of the service. More than special forces, more than Graves registration, even more than those sick fucks at China Lake. At Houndtown, I met handlers from 13 other countries. They all said the same thing. It didn't matter where you were from, what your culture or background, the feelings were still the same. Who could suffer that kind of loss and come out in one piece? Anyone who could wouldn't have made a handler in the first place. That's what made us our own breed. That ability to bond so strongly with something that's not even our own species. The very thing that made so many of my friends take the bullet's way out was what made us one of the most successful outfits in the whole fucking U.S. military. The Army saw it in me. That day on a stretch of a deserted road somewhere in the Colorado Rockies. I'd been on foot since escaping my apartment in Atlanta. 3 months of running, hiding, scavenging. I had rickets, fever. I was down to 96 pounds. I found these two guys under a tree. They were making a fire. Behind them was a little mutt. His paws and snout were bound with shoelaces. Dried blood was caked on his face. He was just lying there, glassy-eyed, whimpering softly.
What happened?
You know, I honestly don't remember. I must have hit one of them with my bat. They found it cracked over his shoulder. They found me on the other guy just pounding his face in. 96 pounds. Half dead myself. And I beat this guy to within an inch of his life. The guardsman had to pull me off. Cuff me to a car hulk. Smack me a couple of times to get me to refocus. That I remember. One of the guys I attacked was holding his arm. The other one was just lying there bleeding. Calm the fuck down, the LT said, trying to question me. What's wrong with you? Why'd you do that to your friends? He's not our friend, the one with the broken arm yelled. He's fucking crazy. And all I kept saying was, don't hurt the dog, don't hurt the dog. I remember the guardsmen just laughed. Jesus Christ, one of them said, looking down at the two guys. The LT nodded, then looked at me. Buddy, he said, I think we got a job for you. And that's how I got recruited. Sometimes you find your path. Sometimes it finds you.
Darnell pets Maze. She cracks one eyelid. Her leathery tail wags. What happened to the dog?
I wish I could give you a Disney ending, like he became my partner or ended up saving a whole orphanage from a fire or something. They'd hit him with a rock to knock him out. Fluid built up in his ear canals. He lost all hearing in one and partial hearing in the other, but his nose still worked, and he did make a pretty good ratter once I found him a home. He hunted enough vermin to keep that family fed all winter. That's kind of a Disney ending, I guess. Disney with Mickey Stew. You want to know something crazy? I used to hate dogs.
Really?
Despise them. Dirty, smelly, slobbering germ bags that humped your leg and made the carpet smell like piss. God, I hated them. I was that guy who come over to your house and refused to pet the dog. I was the guy at work who always made fun of people with dog pictures on their desk. You know that guy who always threatened to call animal control when your pooch barked at night?
He motions to himself.
I lived a block away from the pet store. I used to drive by it every day on my way to work, confounded by how these sentimental, socially incompetent losers could shell out so much money on oversized barking hamsters. During the panic, the dead started to collect around that pet shop. I don't know where the owner was. He pulled down the gates but left the animals inside. I could hear them from my bedroom window all day, all night. Just puppies, you know, a couple of weeks old. Scared little babies screaming for their mommies, for anyone to please come and save them. I heard them die, one by one as their water bottles ran out. The dead never got in. They were still massed outside the gate when I escaped. Ran right past without stopping to look. What could I have done? I was unarmed, untrained. I couldn't have taken care of them. I could barely take care of myself. What could I have done? Something.
Maze sighs in her sleep. Darnell pats her gently.
I could have done something.
Siberia, the Holy Russian Empire. The people who exist in this shantytown do so under the most primitive conditions. There is no electricity, no running water. The huts are grouped together behind a wall cut from the surrounding trees. The smallest hovel belongs to Father Sergei Ryshkov. It is a miracle to see how the old cleric is still able to function. His walk reveals the numerous wartime and post-war injuries. The handshake reveals that all his fingers have been broken. His attempt at a smile reveals that those teeth, not black with decay, have been knocked out a long time ago.
In order to understand how we became a religious state and how that state began with a man like me, you have to understand the nature of our war against the undead. As with so many other conflicts, our greatest ally was General Winter. The biting cold, lengthened and strengthened by the planet's darkened skies, gave us the time we needed to prepare our homeland for liberation. Unlike the United States, we were fighting a war on two fronts. We had the Ural barrier in the west and the Asian swarms from the southeast. Siberia had been stabilized, finally, but was by no means completely secure. We had so many refugees from India and China, so many frozen ghouls that thawed and continued to thaw each spring. We needed those winter months to reorganize our forces, marshal our population, inventory, and distribute our vast stocks of military hardware. We didn't have the war production of other countries. There was no Department of Strategic Resources in Russia. No industry other than finding enough food to keep our people alive. What we did have was our legacy, a legacy of a military-industrial state. I know you in the West have always laughed at us for this folly. Paranoid Ivan, that's what you always called us, building tanks and guns while his people cry out for cars and butter. Yes, the Soviet Union was backward and inefficient, and yes, it did bankrupt our economy on mountains of military might, but when the motherland needed them, those mountains were what saved her children.
He refers to the faded poster on the wall behind him. It shows the ghostly image of an old Soviet soldier reaching down from heaven to hand a crude submachine gun to a grateful young Russian. The caption underneath reads, "Dedushka Spasiba." Thank you, Grandfather.
I was a chaplain with the 32nd Motor Rifle Division. We were a Category D unit, fourth-class equipment, the oldest in our arsenal. We looked like extras in an old great patriotic war movie with our PPSH submachine guns and our bolt-action Mosin-Nagant rifles. We didn't have your fancy new battle dress uniform. We wore the tunics of our grandfathers. Rough, moldy, moth-eaten wool that could barely keep the cold out and did nothing to protect against bites. We had a very high casualty rate, most of it in urban combat, and most of that due to faulty ammunition. Those rounds were older than us. Some of them had been sitting in crates open to the elements since before Stalin breathed his last. You never knew when a Kogov would happen, when your weapon would click at the moment a ghoul was upon you. That happened a lot in the 32nd Motor Rifle Division. We weren't as neat and organized as your army. We didn't have your tight, light little Raj Singh squares or your frugal one-shot, one-kill combat doctrine. Our battles were sloppy and brutal. We plastered the enemy in DSHK heavy machine gun fire, drowned them with flamethrowers and Katyusha rockets, and crushed them under the treads of our prehistoric T-34 tanks. It was inefficient and wasteful, and resulted in too many needless deaths. Ufa was the first major battle of our offensive. It became the reason we stopped going into the cities and started walling them up during winter. We learned a lot of lessons those first months, charging headlong into the rubble after hours of merciless artillery, fighting block by block, house by house, room by room. There were always too many zombies, too many misfires, and always too many bitten boys. We didn't have L-pills like in your army. The only way to deal with infection was a bullet. But who was going to pull the trigger? Certainly not the other soldiers. To kill your comrade, even in cases as merciful as infection, was too reminiscent of the decimations. That was the irony of it all. The decimations had given our armed forces the strength and discipline to do anything we asked of them, anything but that. To ask, even order one soldier to kill another, was crossing a line that might have sparked another mutiny. For a while, the responsibility rested with the leadership, the officers and senior sergeants. We couldn't have made a more damaging decision. To have to look into the faces of these men, these boys whom you were responsible for, whom you fought with side by side, shared bread and blankets, saved his life or have him save yours, who can focus on the monumental burden of leadership after having to commit such an act? We began to see a noticeable degradation among our field commanders. Dereliction of duty, alcoholism, suicide. Suicide became almost epidemic among the officer corps. Our division lost 4 experienced leaders, 3 junior lieutenants and a major, all during the first week of our first campaign. 2 of the lieutenants shot themselves, one right after committing the deed, and the other later that night. The 3rd platoon leader chose a more passive method, what we began to call suicide by combat. He volunteered for increasingly dangerous missions, acting more like a reckless enlisted man than a responsible leader. He died trying to take on 12 ghouls with nothing but a bayonet. Major Kovpak just vanished. No one knows exactly when. We knew he couldn't have been taken. The area was thoroughly swept, and no one, absolutely no one, left the perimeter without an escort. We all knew what probably happened. Colonel Savichev put out an official statement that the major had been sent on a long-range recon mission and had never returned. He even went so far as to recommend him for a first-class Order of the Rodina. You can't stop the rumors, and nothing is worse for a unit's morale than to know that one of their officers has deserted. I could not blame the man. I still cannot. Kovpak was a good man, a strong leader. Before the crisis, he had done 3 tours in Chechnya and 1 in Dagestan. When the dead began to rise, he not only prevented his company from revolting, but led them all, on foot, carrying both supplies and wounded from Kurta in the Salib Mountains all the way to Manaskent on the Caspian Sea. 65 days. 37 major engagements. 37! He could have become an instructor. He'd more than earned the right. And he had even been asked by Stavka because of his extensive combat experience, but no. He volunteered for an immediate return to action. And now, he was a deserter. They used to call this the second decimation, the fact that almost 1 in every 10 officers killed themselves in those days, a decimation that almost brought our war effort to a crushing halt. The logical alternative, the only one, was to, therefore, let the boys commit the act themselves. I can still remember their faces, dirty and pimply, their red-rimmed eyes wide as they closed their mouths around their rifles. What else could be done? It wasn't long before they began to kill themselves in groups, all those who'd been bitten in a battle, gathering at the field hospital to synchronize the moment when they would all pull the trigger. I guess it was comforting, knowing that they weren't dying alone. It was probably the only comfort they could expect. They certainly didn't get it from me. I was a religious man in a country that had long since lost its faith. Decades of communism, followed by materialistic democracy, had left this generation of Russians with little knowledge of or need for the opium of the masses. As a chaplain, my duties were mainly to collect letters from the condemned boys to their families, and to distribute any vodka I managed to find. It was a next to useless existence, I knew, and the way our country was headed, I doubted anything would occur to change that. It was right after the battle for Kostroma, just a few weeks before the official assault on Moscow. I had come to the field hospital to give last rites to the infected. They had been set apart, some badly mauled, some still healthy and lucid. The first boy couldn't have been older than 17. He wasn't bitten. That would have been merciful. The zombie had had its forearms ripped off by the treads of an Su-152 self-propelled gun. All that remained was hanging flesh and broken humerus bones, jagged at the edges, sharp like spears. They stabbed right through the boy's tunic, where whole hands would have just grabbed him. He was lying on a cot, bleeding from his belly, ashen-faced, rifle quivering in his hand. Next to him was a row of 5 other infected soldiers. I went through the motions of telling them I would pray for their souls. They either shrugged or nodded politely. I took their letters, as I'd always done, gave them a drink, and even passed out a couple cigarettes from their commanding officer. Even though I'd done this many times, somehow I felt strangely different. Something was stirring within me, a tense, tingling sensation that began to work its way up through my heart and lungs. I began to feel my whole body tremble as the soldiers all placed the muzzles of their weapons underneath their chins. On 3, the oldest of them said. 1, 2. That was as far as they got. The 17-year-old flew backward and hit the ground. The other stared dumbfounded at the bullet hole in his forehead, then up to the smoking pistol in my hand. In God's hand. God was speaking to me. I could feel his words ringing in my head. No more sinning, he told me. No more souls resigned to hell. It was so clear, so simple. Officers killing soldiers had cost us too many good officers, and soldiers killing themselves had caused the Lord too many good souls. Suicide was a sin, and we, his servants, those who had chosen to be his shepherds upon the earth, were the only ones who should bear the cross of releasing trapped souls from infected bodies. That is what I told Division Commander after he discovered what I had done. And that is the message that spread first to every chaplain in the field, and then to every civilian priest throughout Mother Russia. What later became known as the act of final purification was only the first step of a religious fervor that would surpass even the Iranian Revolution of the 1980s. God knew his children had been denied his love for too long. They needed direction, courage, hope. You could say that it is the reason we emerged from that war as a nation of faith, and have continued to rebuild our state on the basis of that faith.
Is there any truth to the stories of that philosophy being perverted for political reasons?
I don't understand.
The president declared himself head of the church.
Can't a national leader feel God's love?
But what about organizing priests into death squads and assassinating people under the premise of purifying infected victims?
I don't know what you're talking about.
Isn't that why you eventually fell out with Moscow? Isn't that why you're here? There is a long pause. We hear the sounds of footsteps approaching. Someone knocks at the door. Father Sergei opens it to find a small, ragged child. Mud stains his pale, frightened face. He speaks in a frantic, local dialect, shouting and pointing up the road. The old priest nods solemnly, pats the boy on the shoulder, then turns to me.
Thank you for coming. Will you excuse me, please?
As I rise to leave, he opens a large wooden chest at the foot of his bed, removing both a Bible and a World War II-era pistol. Aboard the USS Holokai, off the coast of the Hawaiian Islands. Deep Glider 7 looks more like a twin-fuselage aircraft than a mini-sub. I lie on my stomach in the starboard hull, looking out through a thick, transparent nose cone. My pilot, Master Chief Petty Officer Michael Choi, waves at me from the port hull. Choi is one of the old-timers, possibly the most experienced diver in the U.S. Navy's Deep Submergence Combat Corps, the DSCC. His gray temples and weathered crow's feet clash violently with his almost adolescent enthusiasm. As the mothership lowers us into the choppy Pacific, I detect a trace of surfer dude bleeding through Choi's otherwise neutral accent.
My war never ended. If anything, you could say it's still escalating. Every month we expand our operations and improve our material and human assets. They say there are still somewhere between 20 and 30 million of them, still washing up on beaches or getting snagged in fishermen's nets. You can't work an offshore oil rig or repair a transatlantic cable without running into a swarm. That's what this dive is about. Trying to find them, track them, and predict their movements so maybe we can have some advance warning.
We hit the white caps with a jarring thud. Choi grins, checks his instruments, and shifts the channels on his radio from me to the mothership. The water before my observation dome froths white for a second, then gives way to light blue as we submerge.
You're not going to ask me about scuba gear or titanium shark suits, are you? Because that crap's got nothing to do with my war. Spear guns and bang sticks and zombie river nets? I can't help you with any of that. If you want civilians, talk to civilians.
But the military did use those methods.
Only for brown water ops, and almost exclusively by army pukes. Personally, I've never worn a mesh suit or a scuba rig. Well, at least not in combat. My war is strictly ADS, atmospheric diving suit. Kinda like a space suit and a suit of armor all rolled into one. The technology actually goes back a couple hundred years, when some guy invented a barrel with a faceplate and armholes. After that, you had stuff like the Tritonia and the Neufeld Kunkka. They look like something out of an old 1950s sci-fi movie, Robbie the Robot and shit. It all kind of fell by the wayside when, Do you really care about all this?
Yes, please.
Well, that sort of technology fell by the wayside when scuba was invented. It only made a comeback when divers had to go deep, real deep, to work on offshore oil rigs. You see, the deeper you go, the greater the pressure. The greater the pressure, the more dangerous it is for scuba or similar mixed gas rigs. You've got to spend days, sometimes weeks, in a decompression chamber. And if, for some reason, you have to shoot up to the surface, you get the bends, gas bubbles in the blood, in the brain. And we're not even talking about long-term health hazards like bone necrosis, soaking your body with shit nature never intended to be there.
He pauses to check his instruments.
The safest way to dive, to go deeper, to stay down longer, was to enclose your whole body in a bubble of surface pressure.
He gestures to the compartment around us.
Just like we are now. Safe, protected, still on the surface as far as our body's concerned. That's what an ADS does. Its depth and duration only limited by armor and life support.
So it's like a personal submarine.
Submersible. A submarine can stay down for years, maintaining its own power, making its own air. A submersible can only make short duration dives, like World War II subs, or what we're in now.
The water begins to darken, deepening to a purplish ink.
The very nature of an ADS, the fact that it's really just a suit of armor, makes it ideal for blue and black water combat. I'm not knocking soft suits, you know, shark or other mesh rigs. They've got 10 times the maneuverability, the speed, the agility. But they're strictly shallow water at best. And if, for some reason, a couple of those fuckers get a hold of you, I've seen mesh divers with broken arms, broken ribs, 3 with broken necks. Drowning. If your airline was punctured or the regulators ripped out of your mouth. Even in a hard helmet, on a mesh-lined dry suit, all they'd have to do is hold you down. Let your air run out. I've seen too many guys go out that way. Or else, try to race to the surface and let an embolism finish what Zach started.
Did that happen a lot to mesh suit divers?
Sometimes, especially in the beginning, but it never happened to us. There was no risk of physical danger. Both your body and your life support are encased in a cast aluminum or high-strength composite shell. Most models' joints are steel or titanium. No matter which way Zach turned your arms, even if you managed to get a solid grip, which is hard considering how smooth and round everything is, it was physically impossible to break off a limb. If for some reason you need to jet up to the surface, just jettison your ballast or your thruster pack if you had one. All suits are positively buoyant. They pop right up like a cork. The only risk might be if Zach were clinging to you during the ascent. A couple times I've had buddies surface with uninvited passengers hanging on for dear life. Or on death. Balloon ascents almost never happened in combat. Most ADS models have 48 hours emergency life support. No matter how many G's dogpiled you, no matter if a hunk of debris came crumbling down, or your leg got snagged in an underwater cable, you can sit tight, snug and safe, and just wait for the cavalry. No one ever dives alone. And I think the longest any ADS diver has ever had to cool his heels was 6 hours. There were times, more than I can count on my fingers, where one of us would get snagged, report it, then follow up by saying that there was no immediate danger, and that the rest of the team should assist only after accomplishing their mission.
You say ADS models. Was there more than one type?
We had a bunch. Civilian, military, old, new, well, relatively new. We couldn't build any wartime models, so we had to work with what was already available. Some of the older ones dated back to the 70s, the Jims and Sams. I'm really glad I never had to operate any of those. They only had universal joints and portholes instead of a face bowl, at least on the early gyms. I knew one guy from the British Special Boat Service. He had these Mondo blood blisters, all along his inner thighs from where the gym's leg joints pinched his skin. Kick-ass divers, the SBS. But I never swapped jobs with them. We had three basic U.S. Navy models. The Hardsuit 1200, the 2000, and the Mark I exosuit. That was my baby, the exo. You want to talk about sci-fi? This thing looked like it was made to fight giant space termites. It was much slimmer than either of the two hard suits, and light enough that you can even swim. That was the major advantage over the hard suit. Actually, over all other ADS systems. To be able to operate above your enemy, even without a power sled or thruster packs, that more than made up for the fact that you couldn't scratch your itches. The hard suits were big enough to allow your arms to be pulled into the central cavity to allow you to operate secondary equipment.
What kind of equipment?
Lights, video, side-scanning sonar. The hard suits were full-service units. XOs were the bargain basement. You didn't have to worry about a lot of readouts and machinery. You didn't have any of the distractions or the multitasking of the hard suits. The XO was sleek and simple, allowing you to focus on your weapon and the field in front of you.
What kind of weapons did you use?
At first we had the M9, kind of a cheap, modified knockoff of the Russian APS. I say modified because no ADS had anything close to resembling hands. You either had four-pronged claws or simple industrial pincers. Both worked as hand-to-hand weapons. Just grab a G's head and squeeze. But they made it impossible to fire a gun. The M9 was fixed to your forearm and could be fired electrically. It had a laser pointer for accuracy and air encased cartridges that fired these 4-inch long steel rods. The major problem was that they were basically designed for shallow water operations. At the depth we needed, they imploded like eggshells. About a year in, we got a much more efficient model, the M11, actually invented by the same guy who invented both the hardsuit and XO. I hope that crazy Canuck got an assload of medals for what he's done for us. The only problem with it was that Distress thought production was too expensive. They kept telling us that between our claws and pre-existing construction tools, we had more than enough to handle Zack.
What changed their minds?
Troll. We were in the North Sea, repairing that Norwegian natural gas platform, and suddenly, there they were. We'd expected some kind of attack. The noise and light of the construction site always attracted at least a handful of them. We didn't know a swarm was nearby. One of our sentries sounded off, we headed for his beacon, and we were suddenly inundated. Horrible thing to fight hand-to-hand underwater. The bottom churns up, your visibility is shot, like fighting inside a glass of milk. Zombies don't just die when you hit them. Most of the time they disintegrate. Fragments of muscle, organ, brain matter, mixed up with the silt and swirling around you. Kids today, fucking A, I sound like my pops, but it's true. The kids today, the new ADS divers in the Mark 3s and 4s, they have this ZEVDEC, Zero Visibility Detection Kit, with color imaging sonar and low light optics. The pictures relay through a heads-up display right on your face bowl, like a fighter plane. Throw in a pair of stereo hydrophones and you've got a real sensory advantage over Zack. That was not the case when I first went XO. We couldn't see. We couldn't hear. We couldn't even feel if a G was trying to grab us from behind.
Why was that?
Because the one fundamental flaw of an ADS is complete tactical blackout. The simple fact that the suit is hard means you can't feel anything from the outside world, even if a G has his hands right on you. Unless Zack is actively tugging, trying to pull you back or flip you around, you may not know he's there until his face is right up against yours. That night at Troll, our helmet lights only made the problem worse by throwing up a glare that was only broken by an undead hand or face. That was the only time I was ever spooked. Not scared, you understand, just spooked. Swinging in this liquid chalk and suddenly a rotten face is jammed against my face bowl. The civilian oil workers? They wouldn't go back to work. Even under threat of reprisals. Until we, their escorts, were better armed. They'd lost enough of their people already. Ambushed out of the darkness. Can't imagine what that must have been like. You're in this dry suit, working in near pitch black. Eyes stinging from the light of the welding torch. Body numb from the cold or else burning from the hot water pumped through the system. Suddenly you feel these hands or teeth. You struggle, call for help, try to fight or swim as they pull you up. Maybe a few body parts will rise to the surface. Maybe they'll just pull up a severed lifeline. That was how the DSCC came into being as an official outfit. Our first mission was to protect the rig divers, keep the oil flowing. Later, we expanded to beachhead sanitation and harbor clearing.
What is beachhead sanitation?
Basically, helping the jarheads get ashore. What we learned during Bermuda, our first amphibious landing, was that the beachhead was coming under constant attack by G's walking out of the surf. We had to establish a perimeter, a semicircular net around the proposed landing area that was deep enough for ships to pass over, but high enough to keep out Zack. That's where we came in. 2 weeks before the landings took place, a ship would anchor several miles offshore and start banging away with their active sonar. That was to draw Zack away from the beach.
Wouldn't that sonar also lure in zombies from deeper water?
The brass told us that was an acceptable risk. I think they didn't have anything better. That's why it was an ADS op. Too risky for mesh divers. You knew that masses were gathering under that pinging ship, and that once they went silent, you'd be the brightest target out there. It actually turned out to be the closest thing we ever had to a cakewalk. The attack frequency was the lowest by far, and when the nets were up, they had an almost perfect success rate. All you needed was a skeleton force to keep a constant vigil. Maybe snipe the occasional G that tried to climb the fence. They didn't really need us for this kind of op. After the first three landings, they went back to using mesh divers.
And harbor clearing?
That was not a cakewalk. That was in the final stages of the war, when it wasn't just about opening a beachhead, but reopening harbors for deep water shipping. That was a massive combined operation. Mesh divers, ADS units, even civilian volunteers, with nothing but a scuba rig and a spear gun. I helped clear Charleston, Norfolk, Boston, freaking Boston, and the mother of all subsurface nightmares, the Hero City. I know grunts like to bitch about fighting to clear a city, but imagine a city underwater. A city of sunken ships and cars and planes and every kind of debris imaginable. During the evacuation, when a lot of container ships were trying to make as much room as they could, a lot of them dumped their cargo overboard. Couches, toaster ovens, mountains and mountains of clothes. Plasma TVs always crunched when you walked over them. I always imagined it was bone. I also imagined I could see Zack behind each washer and dryer, climbing over each pile of smashed air conditioners. Sometimes it was just my imagination, but sometimes, the worst. The worst was having to clear a sunken ship. There were always a few that had gone down within the harbor boundaries. A couple, like the Frank Cable, big subtender turned refugee ship, had gone down right at the mouth of the harbor. Before she could be raised, we had to do a compartment-by-compartment sweep. That was the only time the XO ever felt bulky, unwieldy. I didn't smack my head in every passageway, but it sure as hell felt like it. A lot of the hatches were blocked by debris. We either had to cut our way through them or through the decks and bulkheads. Sometimes the deck had been weakened by damage or corrosion. I was cutting through a bulkhead above the cable's engine room when suddenly the deck just collapsed under me. Before I could swim, before I could think, there were hundreds of them in the engine room. I was engulfed, drowning in legs and arms and hunks of meat. If I ever had a recurring nightmare, and I'm not saying I do, because I don't, but if I did, I'd be right back in there. Only this time, I'm completely naked. I mean, I would be.
I am surprised at how quickly we reach the bottom. It looks like a desert wasteland, glowing white against the permanent darkness. I see the stumps of wire coral, broken and trampled by the living dead.
There they are.